Well, hi, everybody, and welcome. This is Dave. Thank you again for the comments, the kind words, and the questions that you've sent in by email after we've begun, as well as those of you who did that at the beginning. I reviewed them to be sure that I've incorporated a part of each of our seminars to include the things that you've asked. So we're going to talk in this seminar about some specific challenges and opportunities in transitions. And just to reiterate, for a couple of the repeated questions, especially how can you help someone change? Here's a quote from the 1600s. Blaise Pascal, French mathematician and philosopher, said this: "People are generally better persuaded by the reasons which they have themselves discovered than by those which have come into the minds of others." So, and remember this in perspective. We each have the conviction that we see things as they are, that our beliefs and responses are determined by objective perceptions. And just given the right information, other rational and reasonable people would reach the same conclusions that we have. So it's so tempting to offer suggestions, advice, directives to our clients. But what we've come to know is that we commit to what we co-create. So we want to focus with a point of reference on the client story, not usurping that to make our advice, our input, as the point of reference and help the client develop that story themselves. Anything you'd like to add or ask or comment on before we get into the material of our final seminar? Any questions that are still unanswered or things that you would like for me to elaborate a bit more on or that you would have more comments about in any way?
Natalie here?
Yes, I can hear. Yeah, go ahead. Thank you.
Thank you. It's just a quick question, as I've just been overlooking reading the material about seminar four, and you talk about transitioning, like different situations, like special challenges in dealing with situations and emotions of transition. And it talks about, for example, like job, significant relationship, disability, divorce, professional athletes. Can we apply all what you've been saying about transition to anything in life? For example, like I'm a person who wants to, break the barrier of their finances and so they can transition to a different life. Or can we apply these principles to anything, or is it mostly concentrated about jobs, disability, divorce, professional athletes, and so on?
My vote goes with anything. I want to put that in context. Now, we've talked about a couple of things that I think are fundamental for your answer. One is we're talking about fundamental aspects of mind and brain and performance science, how people think and how their brain works so that we can align what we're doing in our collaboration with them with ways that will make sense and will be incorporated into a change process. And the other part of that is, remember when we talked about the roadmap system, and I jumped ahead for that to do that in seminar two. That roadmap is the essence of understanding the algorithms that go into creating any story, whether that's life, career, money, relationship, any story that someone has, so that this way of understanding, and this is for us as coaches, to understand the algorithms of how someone constructs their story in a here and now way in order to help them revise that story or to create a new one. So when we talk about any aspect or any of the things that you mentioned for someone's personal story, to recognize, observe, assess, decide, map steps, author the new story, and program new identity. That will apply to any aspect of what someone does in their own way. So I think it's important that we can understand that in order to make it about the client and to facilitate, to be a catalyst for the client to develop their story in their own way, because that will be the unique and creative aspect is when they do it themselves. And remember, I also said that we don't need to go into the past. We don't need to go into history or development or dynamics or other earlier issues. Every algorithm that's important in someone's life will, in a here and now way, manifest in the coaching relationship, in the process of it. Every thought, feeling, behavior, every aspect of how someone constructs their story, every algorithm will manifest. So you'll get a chance to see it in vivo. And it's the process of what happens while we're talking about other things or maybe focusing on content. And that's why I emphasize not getting really lost in just a tangible, specific focus on content and mapping that out, but really to listen for the process. That's where you'll hear if there are unconscious biases, if there are blind spots, if there are limiting assumptions, all the things that will be most useful for a client to know in order to understand and revise will be manifest in the coaching conversation. Now, does that answer your question in an understandable way?
Yes, absolutely. It's wonderful. Thank you so much. And I love your course. It's been tremendously eye-opener and wonderful. And I look forward to more courses from you. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much. I'm glad you found it useful. And review those seven steps. Now, again, that's not an exercise to give to a client, but that's just for us to listen and help organize a way that we listen and understand in order to know how to facilitate a process of understanding and collaboration for the client to change in the way that the client wants. So,
thank you.
Absolutely. Anything else? Who else? Comments, questions, things that you want to be sure we cover in our final seminar? I'll reserve some time at the end for us to discuss, so jot down anything that you feel we haven't discussed or you'd like to revisit or do a bit more. I'm going to put us on lecture mode so you don't have to worry about the background noise. So we're going to talk about specific challenges and opportunities in transitions. First, let me talk a little bit with you about niche coaching. Practicing professionals like healthcare, financial, legal, have in common that they've dedicated their careers to a body of knowledge. Their clients come to them for the purpose of purchasing their expertise. Their expertise to solve special problems and give advice is backed by their own professional standards, substantiated by codes and often laws. But even with rigorous training to solve specialized problems, these and other professionals and other experts provide specialized advice but have not been trained, perhaps, to do the things that we can do with them, to know themselves better, to understand the dynamics of human behavior, to remove stress as an obstacle to their success, to pursue personal development as vigorously as they pursue professional advancement, to convert from work ethic to performance ethic, to emotionally and strategically manage career transitions. Because most people, probably, like all of us and like me, assume they do one thing, the profession they train for, all their lives. And another genre that we can wrap in this discussion, performance professionals, actors, professional athletes, the primary challenge these clients have is self-regulation, to stay grounded in their ideals and energy management in the face of extraordinary demands and stimulating success, especially retirement transitions for pro athletes, as an example. Here's a lesson we can learn about the importance of self-regulation for all loss, change, and transition. Champion sports figures are alert to the importance of aftermath. The points are the play immediately following a tense and hotly contested moment of play, or an exceptionally exciting play. The winner's excited about the victory. If someone makes a mistake, it's the depth of despair for at least the next moment, and it can carry over into affecting the next play. The loser's frustrated, which carries over into an error in the next step. These aftermath points and play are likely to be lost on errors. The wise player approaches the aftermath with self-regulation, conservatively and with full concentration. And I'm using the illustration here of sports, but this is true for everything that we do. The most vulnerable time that someone has is right after a big win or a big loss. Let me give you an example of the use of grounding and centering and having a way systematically to do that in an effective way. I work with an all-pro cornerback, and football, as you know, is an episodic game. It's not a flow like basketball. So a player will get up for a play, and then there'll be a downtime until the ball is snapped again. So especially after a really good play or a really bad one, or just the play doesn't come to his part of the field, it's hard to stay grounded and centered and sustain that performance flow. So what he learned to do is to immediately reset to get that grounded and centered performance flow. So he learned to say simply, reset. And instantly that booted up his performance flow so that he was 100% immersed in the play for the next play. Now here's an example. The announcer at a Texans game who commented on defensive lineman Casey. That's so often the case with young players. One good play, then one bad one. After doing a spectacular tackle on the next play, Casey was offsides. Clearly an instance of self-regulation and being on tilt. The excitement from making a really good play. Excitement is at least as hard to deal with. And you will see in your work with clients, probably have already seen, at least as challenging, as really difficult and tumultuous times, is success and handling success, especially if it's unprecedented. We'll return to that in the discussion if you're interested. Success does not create an immunity to failure. A loss does not foreclose lack of confidence or disbelief. The next play is the next play. The next point is the next point. You've lost something very important, yet tomorrow is the next day. Your next career, to look at it from a wider angle lens, is the same thing. This is the aftermath of everything you've done before, everything you've worked hard for. It will stand alone on its own. Additional people who have significant challenge in dealing with the emotions of a transition are the ones whose process begins with a significant and often abrupt loss, like the loss of a job, a significant relationship, a disability, a divorce. Be thinking niches here as you're listening to me give some examples. With these changes and subsequent transitions, the need for help in managing emotions and regulating states of mind is supremely important in itself. Then this task becomes important as it affects other components of a situation. For example, the significant emotion of a divorce in the subsequent divorce proceeding and asset management create challenges, such as making the business aspect of the divorce only about the business of divorce, not letting emotional factors derail logic and judgment. This has been an aspect of what my clients and I have focused on, those who go through a divorce, is to keep that perspective, that the business aspect of the divorce is that, and to keep as much as possible emotion out of it, even to delegate to experts the business components. Studies show how even highly accomplished people close themselves to novelty as they get older. Major factor is not their age, but how long they've been doing a particular thing. Think about how long their brains have been going over the same hardwiring, such as been in a particular business. People who stay in one place, in one position, get most entrenched. An example here of where I see this challenge in change and transition is family succession of business. The founder passes the company begun 32 years ago to two children to own and manage, now adults. It's a challenge because everyone changes roles and relationships and work function. So this is important to think about. One of the things that I've done is work with a buddy of mine who retired at a very early age as a senior executive at IBM, and he and I have done retreats alternating between his ranch and my ranch for people who are about to retire. It's called What's Next Exec, and people who have been doing the same job and the same executive function for a long time may not have recognize the things they need to do. So this is for people who are within a year of retirement to look at this change and this transition, and especially to consider what their next challenge, what their next contribution will be, how they will navigate this whole process. I'll return to this at the very end with the question I asked you at the beginning of seminar two. So retired is not an identity. It's kind of a lack of one, but it's a framework for a beginning transition. So I want to back up and think in a broad sense with you. What do clients want from us? Think about how you would answer that right now. What do you think clients most want from you as a mentor coach? The coach and client become co-authors of a new story and create a current meaning that allows a distinctness of the old versus the new in evolving a new story. As I saw in psychiatry and psychoanalysis, coming to the end of the past very successfully for my patients did not help them create a new story going forward, especially in their business or especially in unprecedented things. We're always teaching others how to respond to us. A client is always teaching the coach what it's like to be him or her, creating an in vivo demonstration of what needs to be known so that the coach can teach it back out loud. We as coaches have to be open to that learning and not let teaching the client our theories or our agenda or our best answers get in the way. Although we inevitably listen within the context of our own system of meaning and knowing, and that's called being human, because we have to, we continuously bridge the experience and system of meaning to resonate with the clients. In this co-created space, the client develops an authentic story. What our clients want from us as coaches, I believe, is the adult version of what we as children wanted from our parents. Our clients want unself-conscious participation in serious work and sometimes in play. Remember from my grandmother, if you're not having fun, you're not doing it right. I believe they want acceptance of praise, that we accept praise without embarrassment or deflection so that we can give it back to its creator as their self-statement. They want full immersion in, yet not full reaction to, their full feelings, never losing sight of their internal perspective and best interest. To hope that we will see the self the client hopes to become and see the evolving new story that sometimes gets obscured from the client's view. I had someone once put that in such a succinct way. You know, Dave, I want you to stand up for the part of me that I may not even know yet. She had a deal, and even though she didn't know it, we did soon enough. To see at times a thought, a feeling, or behavior as the answer to a question its creator has not consciously dared to ask. Now, I got that from X-Files, but I'm sticking to it. To hope that we hear the silent intent embedded in the sometimes compromised result, to see the hope camouflaged in the frustrating process, to validate their intuition, to hope that the coach will not be awkward or self-conscious or say anything that would distract from the client's immersion in the process. The architecture of trust silently forms while we're talking about other things. Collaborating together, even laughing together, gives oxygen to hope, highlights the relief and release of new experience, pushes creativity to full flight. We help the client mourn the old story. We know that no matter how ready to change they are, it's still like saying goodbye to an old friend who's been there for a long time. The client mourns the self that they leave behind, the self of the old story. Invention has been sabotaged and creativity imprisoned by remaining in an old story, repeating the same storylines. Julia Cameron said it beautifully and succinctly in The Artist's Way. I'm astounded that I could let go of the drama of being a starving artist. Nothing dies harder than a bad idea. We are in the present moment together and co-create a new story with our clients. We believe in someone until they can believe in themselves, and they'll teach us both why. The corollary to believing in the client is that the coach must be the kind of person in whom the client can believe and respect and trust. The client has to believe the coach will respond, guide, teach, model in a way that facilitates growth. This bond, this immersion and understanding within the present moment may be one of the most powerful and most change-making experiences that the client has ever had. I remain curious about how my clients continue to write their narratives after we end formal or regular coaching. I believe that coaching is a developmental process continuing in its influence throughout life. I have said to clients, I'm going to be your coach for life. Regular meetings will be necessary only for a short period of time, though. Intervals, perhaps of quarterly or yearly updates, can be beneficial for both coach and client, kind of like booster shots. Witnessing a continuing developmental journey at regular intervals, and the framework is shifted that there doesn't have to be challenges or problems in order to have a coaching session. What we do with each client is not about being right, about having pristine theory and technique, or even mutually idealizing achievement. But the bottom line, our bottom line always is, does it work? Because the client has that question too, maybe not articulated as much with as much specificity as we do or need to. Coaching allows the beauty of waking up to specific possibilities, strengths, untapped resources. We help people become more of who they really are. The client must risk bringing an issue to the table and further that risk by looking at it. The exchange must be worthy and true. It must be real. The coach must be fully present, fully himself or herself. Hemingway captured this principle, I believe, when he wrote about the craft of writing. Write the truest sentence you know. So we may nudge a client to consider their relationship with themselves, and we wonder sometimes out loud, how exactly are you taking care of yourself? This is one of the questions I'll ask at often close to the beginning of mentor coaching work with a new client, to look at what are they doing mind, body, spirit? How are they taking care of themselves? Are they working out regularly? Now, I'm not a, you know, I'm not a workout coach, but I'll want to understand that as much as I understand other aspects. How are you honoring your needs and ideals? Your relationships. Have you created something that now seems to be controlling you? This is a question in the background because it's not something that I would ask to be consciously answered. Are you, and these are also questions, are you framing yourself by your gender, your role, your purpose? Do you find things to be grateful for, to celebrate? An ideal coaching co-creation is to reflect or validate the client, to tell the client what they already know and just a little bit more, or a question about a little bit more. What else? Are there other possibilities? That little more may be a challenge, a conceptualization, a nudge toward initiative or action, or a reminder to pause momentarily to consider, to contemplate, to celebrate. Now, this is in your outline, but I want to review with you 12 caveats, 12 and counting, about how we facilitate change in mentor coaching. One, each person's life story is created. Recognition and acceptance of story ownership is a prerequisite to assessment and change. To say that a slightly different way, whatever we think and feel and experience, we create each moment. And whatever you create, I'm sorry, whatever you experience, you either create or you accept. Understanding begins with examination of which storylines work and which don't. Then to change the one, or even as basic as assumptions, then to change the ones that don't work. The ones that do work may be kept, possibly enhanced. And you've heard this principle from me more than once, I know. In coaching, if it works, do more of it. If it doesn't work, do something else. Three, knowing what not to do is at least as important as knowing what to do. Now, I got this next sentence that I'm about to tell you, and he gave me full license, full permission to use it, back in the day when I had a service on the alcohol treatment unit in a psychiatric hospital, a great codger, and he called himself that, who was an alcohol counselor. And he was so confronted and so good and so many people he helped. He said, you may not always know what the next right thing is, but you can almost always know what it isn't. And that's kind of huge. 4, distinguish what to change, what to accept, what to let go, and what to enhance. Accept, let go, change, and enhance. Placing energy into what works, coupled with accepting and letting go what cannot be changed, can result in a significant improvement in effectiveness. 5, when people create their own answers, they've signed on to invest in the outcome. We commit to what we co-create. We have an ownership in it. 6, someone has to change an internal model of assumption to sustain a new story. Remember when we talked about the last step of the roadmap? After putting it into action, experiencing the effectiveness of it, is to program new identity. All the change in the world, unless it's incorporated into the working model of how and who you see yourself, will revert back to the pre-existing hardwiring that's already been there for doing it the way before the change. So this process of repetition and focusing on change, when it's incorporated into someone's identity, someone's basic working model of how and who they see themselves to be, that's when it becomes permanent, when it's part of their identity. Because the identity is the most powerful force of the human psyche. We always revert to our core identity. This is why it needs to be addressed in coaching, to highlight the transition that someone's making and how and who they see themselves to be. Seven, we don't see things as they are, we see things as we are. Learn to recognize your own assumptions and beliefs and how they color your perception. Assumptions manifest as beliefs and behaviors. By making assumptions explicit, those which facilitate and those which interfere can become visible and distinct. 8, change is constant and inevitable. It's resistance to change that generates most problems. People are most successful when they learn from yesterday, anticipate tomorrow, and integrate the impact of new experience. If someone's protesting change, they've already engaged it. 9, small changes lead to big changes. Issues that can seem overwhelmingly large and insurmountable can be approached by looking at the simplicity of the issue and specify a first step to take for progress. For example, professionals get overwhelmed with the amount of tasks and responsibilities. Don't be afraid to get simple. Focus on and clarify one issue that can be dealt with effectively within the next day. This focus on a specific action exercises effectiveness and initiates a model of mastery. Solutions, causes, and problems are not always related or even interconnected. The therapist attunes to problems, conflict, and development for progress to occur. Coaching uses this space to focus on the choice architecture of this moment's choice, of creating a new story that aligns needs and ideals to strategize toward the specific goal determined by the client. The coach listens to join talents and strengths with possibilities and vision to co-create a strategic pursuit of goals, to co-create that map for each session. 11, a collaboration brings both individuals to the same side, looking at the same scene together. Empathic resonance generates a feeling of being understood. Then you can make powerful coaching collaborations and interventions. Also, validation of what's positive will have several times the effect of focus on the negative. A comment perceived as judgmental often results in a defensive reaction. What we know now from neuroscience and conversational intelligence is the first few words that someone hears, whether they're spoken or written, will boot up a mindset to process the remainder of the conversation. If those first words are perceived as judgmental or critical in any way, then someone moves into a more protective mode and a mindset that cautions against too much disclosure. If those first few words are perceived as collaborative and engaging and empathic, boots up a whole different mindset mediated by oxytocin that elaborates the collaborative framework to move ahead and can last the entire conversation. And 12, the benefits of doing more of what's working and less of what's not will become evident and self-perpetuating. Again, don't be afraid to be simple. You have got nothing to prove or to show your worth or your value as a professional coach except to do what you do as a professional coach. A physician client who's completed the 26th grade may have forgotten how to talk simply. Remember, how you work with your client provides a model that will be imitated, internalized, of how they can work with themselves and develop that self-empathy for self-reflection, and with their patients or their clients. Now, here's a component to consider, your wellness story. A significant aspect of change and transition is to incorporate your wellness story. Wellness is a mindset. It gives ownership of the life story to the individual. With this ownership comes the responsibility and privilege that each thought, feeling, experience, and behavior is created each moment. Warren Buffett used the analogy of buying a car. If you got a new car every few years, the approach would be different than if from the beginning you knew you were going to choose one car and have it for the rest of your life. You'd probably do more research about best care for the car, change the oil, do everything possible for maintenance, knowing that it will be the only car for the rest of your life you take meticulous care of it. Your body is the only one you'll have for the rest of your life. Your body is irreplaceable. Everything about its care and maintenance matters. It reflects the cumulative care you take of it. Wellness integrates mind, body, and spirit with a balanced flow of energy. Wellness is a system of energy, and it's an ongoing process of choices. It's a choice we make every day, moment by moment. It's not some big monumental choice, but on little things. If you plan to run 30 minutes on the treadmill, after 10 you get off, you're a little stiff, it's one small choice, no big deal. Nobody's ever had a heart attack because 20 minutes less on the treadmill that day. You resolve to cut empty calories, but then you grab a few peanut M&Ms. Take 100 calories more each day in than you burn. In 1 year, you gain 9 pounds. Our wellness is the cumulative result of daily choices that we don't rationalize away or justify into oblivion. Now, we are in a revolution of the science of wellness and of aging. We understand how our bodies work at the cellular level. We understand healthy aging. We can live healthier lives than anyone in all of biological time. This has taken a while because health is biologically more complex than disease. Let me give you just a couple of examples, and I promise not to belabor this. Dr. Henry Lodge, Jr., has written a book, Younger Next Year, and a companion book, Younger Next Year for Women. He's an internist in New York City who's devoted his professional lifetime to wellness and wellness research. I became familiar with his work when we shared a venue in presentation. He believes that 70% of aging is not aging but decay, and that both decay and functional aging are largely optional. Here's a quote from Lodge in Younger Next Year. Steady exercise is a coded message to your body and your mind. In 20 years, failure to exercise 6 days a week will seem as self-destructive as smoking 2 packs of cigarettes a day. Now, here's the specifics. According to Dr. Lodge, after age 50, 6 days a week for the rest of your life to work out daily is mandatory. 4 of those, cardiovascular, and the other 2, serious aerobic exercise the rest of your life. Because your body only knows 2 things, growth or decay. So of several thousand people surveyed, 3 activities stood out above all others that prompted procrastination. Exercise, nutritional plan, retirement plan. Now, here's how he put it in terms of framing. When you get up, you go to work each day. It's just part of what you do. It's part of your identity. You don't bargain with yourself. You don't say, if I go to work in the next 2 days, I'll take part of next week off. You don't feel that you've done something grand if you go to work. It's just part of what you do. It's a mindset of what you do. Work is there. You get up, you go to work. He said this exercise can be the same mindset. According to Lodge, daily exercise, like work, should be right up there, trumped only by serious illness or family needs, the default story. Now, you're not a personal trainer or a dietitian. You're not given directives, but you can get curious together with a client. Here is a focus I want to share just for a moment with you. 2 things above all others create neurogenesis, the making of new brain cells: enriched environment and exercise. An enriched environment, intellectual and emotional stimulation, creates more complex brain structure. Now, the hippocampus is the part of the midbrain especially connected with 2 things, creativity and memory. Mice from an enriched environment increase the number of their hippocampal cells by 15%. Those in that study, the mice who did physical exercise increased the number of cells in the hippocampus by almost 100%. Again, the hippocampus, the site of memory and creativity. Another finding, chronic stress impairs neurogenesis. It goes the other direction. There have been a couple of studies more recently, non-invasive studies on humans, that have essentially the same results of those mice studies about enhancing the number of cells in the hippocampus. One was on University of Hamburg medical students. Another was on London taxicab drivers. So one thing I want to add before we depart this in terms of identity and self-identification, and I think you'll find this is interesting, and especially in terms of what you may want to consider asking your clients. Emily Pronin at Princeton did a study to look at how people made financial decisions, especially how much money they put away toward retirement. What she found was what they put toward retirement depends on how closely they identify with their future selves. When people can picture their future self, what they'll look like at 70 or 80 or more, when they have a clear picture of that, they save at 2 to 3 times the rate for their retirement as people who don't or can't picture that. Now, in more recent studies, there's been computer-enhanced aging and simulation that somebody can be shown in a computer-enhanced version what they'll look like at 70 and 80. This increases savings rate. If someone is smoking, there's a computer enhancement every 10 years of what they'll look like if they keep smoking and if they don't. Same way if they gain a few pounds a year versus not. So this kind of visualization can be very helpful. And you probably don't need a program to do it, but your clients will be able to look at how they see themselves and how they want to see themselves. So I want to move toward a conclusion. Your story and the story of your clients hides in plain sight. Think about the difference of people who lead a reactive life where circumstances and others determine their decisions and directions, who talk about what they're going to do, but who do the same thing week after week. By contrast, those who accomplish and believe have a different story. They create a different story, and their lives embody that evolving story. Their story, their plot, guides them, orients them to continually write new script with a growth mindset. Now, through these seminars, we've talked about how someone's story is hiding in plain sight. It's in the open waiting to be seen, then transformed. In these seminars, we've been discussing how to help people write the next chapter of aspects of their life and business stories. Here are some things to consider. Just think of the first thing that comes to mind for you for these questions. If your story to this point would be published as a book, what would the title and the subtitle be? If your story builds to a major achievement in the near future, what will that achievement be? Describe a scenario in your story in which you, the protagonist, faced a major setback that brought out the best in you to successfully overcome it. The first thing you think of. What aspects of your story do you want to enhance? What aspects of your story do you want to leave out as you move ahead? What events or process foreshadows your next success? What roles will the most important people in your life play as you go forward? And finally, what is your spiritual essence? Now, remember, you don't have to be religious in order to have spiritual meaning and significance and purpose. And we're talking mind, body, spirit, not formal religion here. So I want to wrap this and save some time for questions and discussion. I want to talk about the life stages of success. So in doing this, we're moving beyond the wide-angle lens, and we're going to do time-lapse photography here. Success may mean different things at different points in adult life, at each developmental phase. Here's how it may look in a relationship. And I'm summarizing with quotes from different people who have said this in a way more succinct way than I ever had could. This is from Ruby Dee, I Dream a World, in terms of how it may look in a relationship. It takes a long time to be really married. One marries many times at many levels in a marriage. If you have more marriages than divorces within the marriage, you're lucky and you stick it out. Here's a way of looking at individual success. This is from Wolfgang von Goethe. Whoever in middle age attempts to realize the wishes of his early youth, wishes and hopes of his early youth, invariably deceives himself. Each 10 years of a person's life has its own fortunes, its own hopes, its own desires. Dreams change. We realize some, relinquish some, create new ones. Growth, hopefully, is flexible and dynamic. Once you achieve monetary success and professional prestige, you can figure out what's really important, or ideally before, that will facilitate more, better, and faster of that. Here's a caveat. Be sure success doesn't constrict you from doing what you really want to do. And here's that time-lapse photo from a different perspective, from one of my favorite essayists, Emerson. Not in his goals, but in his transitions, man is great. I'd like to do a final exercise with you. I'd like you to get very relaxed in your seat. Close your eyes and keep them closed for the exercise. Breathe in relaxation and breathe out any tension. One more deep breath to breathe in relaxation and breathe out tension. With your eyes still closed, imagine you're 90 years old. Look back at yourself now from 90 years old. Look at how things will turn out on your present trajectory. How could they turn out on a different path? Does the difference between the two suggest a change, a transition? What kind? Be specific. From 90 looking back, what do you see that you might have really seen right now but didn't acknowledge? What do you feel about your situation now? What do you want to tell yourself now? For example, any turns or cautions or risk or bold moves that you should have taken? Keep your eyes closed and look carefully at your 90-year-old eyes, your face, your hands, your 90-year-old body. Look around at where you are and at who's there with you. Remember, you always know more than you think. One final question. I began with seminar 2. I want to ask it now, and I'd like to open your eyes. Sorry. And write down the first answer that comes to your mind. It's important that you do it immediately, first answer, and I'll explain why. What is your unlived life? Write down your answer. The reason I ask you to do it immediately is because when we do an immediate answer, that really is processed more midbrain and emotionally, rather than moving toward the left prefrontal cortex and thinking about it intellectually, consciously, and logically. So that answer may be a truer answer if it's something you did immediately. When my buddy and I, as I mentioned, did that retreat, those series of retreats, I did this on the very first retreat we did, and I continued it with subsequent ones because a number of people, more than half of the people, when they were reviewing and saying what was the standout moment, over half of them said that question and what I came to with that question was the most remarkable thing for me, the most unexpected thing of the entire series that we did 2.5 days. So what is your unlived life is, I think, something that you may want to think about. And I'll tell you, this became intriguing enough to me. I did a series of white papers for the people who did my seminars, the specialty certification for wellness, for new money story, and ultimately peak performance. And the series of white papers are compiled into a book called a book called Engaging the Ineffable. The subtitle is Toward Mindfulness and Meaning. There are 21 different essays that really started out as white papers for coaches. So I want to open this for discussion now, if you'll manage the background noise. I very much appreciate all of your input, your considerations throughout the series and the feedback that I've got. It's been a privilege to do this, to work with you, and I welcome, as soon as I get off lecture mode, I welcome questions and comments. We're in discussion mode. I'm interested in any questions, thoughts, things that you'd like to talk more about.
Hi, David. Can you hear me? This is Zuleika Smith.
Yes. Hey, how are you?
Hi. Pretty good. Thank you so much for all of your time, your energy, and information. I am coming from an educator background in the public school system, an administrator. Do you have any suggestions in terms of the scope and sequence of, like, what type of topic to start with in coaching? I've coached teachers before, but not specifically individually like this.
Okay, help me know the context that you're asking. Are you talking about a meeting with people? Or are you talking about individual? Tell me the context. Who am I looking at if I'm you and engaging in a conversation?
So, for example, I may be coaching a teacher or a clinician after their, on a weekly basis. So it could be a science teacher this week, could be a clinician next week.
Okay, this is a group of similar.
No, individually. Individually.
Oh, you're doing it individually.
Right.
So is this a repeated, you're doing a stint of how long? What's the framework of what you're doing? Individual work?
So ideally, I would be coaching them probably 4 times a month individually. And based on their needs and concerns, I want to frame it around that. But I want to know, do you have any idea of, like, how to start? What type of topic what type of topic to start with?
Well, if it's truly mentor coaching and it's not training or education or anything like that, I would use the framework of mentor coaching. And I preface that with telling a client I work with in mentor coaching that everything is confidential and privileged. I send them a client information packet, a 2 or 3 page thing, that asks them various questions about what they want to work on, what they'd like to get accomplished, what they'd want from me, so that they've begun to think about it, and I have a copy of that, and they have a copy when they began. if you're interested in my, I tell you what, I'll just send my client information packet that I use with clients to each of you. And you're free to use it. Be sure and, you know, customize it to your. Yeah, you'll see at the end there's an agreement that I have with a person. But then I would begin with a basic coaching model of looking for each session at what someone wants to focus on, where they want to get to, and then collaboratively pursuing that, and then asking at the end, what's the most important thing you're taking away? And then based on that, what do you commit to do before we meet again? Does that answer your question?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Absolutely. One of the things that was at least as important to me as the training that I did when I made my transition, in addition to the coach-specific training, was I worked with a mentor coach on a weekly basis who had gone through the same kind of transition that I had from a very well-respected professional in the mental health area to mentor coaching. That was at least as helpful to me. So I'd encourage you, any of you who can, to look at possibly hiring a mentor coach, and that can have an exponential return both for developing a practice, for skill development, and all kinds of things. Or to seek a program that might help you more if you're totally new to this, to look at how and what you may want to develop. So thanks for that, and I hope that's helpful. I know that's kind of, you know,
some brush strokes
there.
Thank you so much.
I know we're a little past time, but any other questions, any other things you'd like to add or ask? Well, I want to emphasize, if there are any questions or things in follow-up, fire off an email, and I'll be happy to respond. I'll be eager to be of whatever help I can. I'll send you that client information packet if you want to feel free to plagiarize it. I did in putting it together from a number of sources. And it's something that I request two things of a client before we have our first standing appointment, if it's a weekly standing time. One is to fill out that client information packet and get it back to me as an attachment, an email, and I send a link for a monthly retainer for them to pay, and then that monthly retainer recurs until they unsubscribe. So I'll be happy to share that. That's a little bit of context for the client information packet, because they begin the process before it happens, because they're thinking about some things that are going to be useful for both of you to have as you begin session one. So thanks very much. Don't hesitate to let me know if there's any way I can be of help to you. I'll be eager to hear from you. Thanks very, very much for all your participation, input, and kind words. Thanks.
Thank you, Doc.
Thanks.
Okay,
bye.
Thank you, guys.
Thank
bye
you.
Now.
Thank you so much.
Yeah,
thank you.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Totally.
Oh.